Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and you're listening to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. Welcome. My aim is to bring you down-to-earth, conversational episodes that help you develop a deeper understanding of how your body's changing in your 40s, and most importantly, how you can support yourself throughout this wonderful transitional phase of your life. Join me for my solo episodes and also episodes with guests for fun, fresh, truthful chat on all things health and happiness in your 40s. And now onto the episode. Welcome back to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast with me, your host, Francesca. So in today's episode, it kind of follows on from last week, episode 48, only in that we touched on food in terms of what's best to eat in your 40s in perimenopause, because so many women as they're navigating perimenopause or even just as they turn into their 50s, they start to wonder, what should I actually eat? What should I be eating anything differently? Should I be eating in a way that is more supportive of this stage of life? Should I be eating in a way to feel better? Is there, you know, or even if it is that somebody has noticed, for example, increasing weight gain for no particular reason. So they haven't changed how they eat, they haven't changed how they move, but they're just thinking, is there something that I need to be doing differently? And also just online, I see it online, I get asked all the time, literally the question, what is the best diet for perimenopause? What is the best diet for menopause? What is the best diet for XYZ? And the answer isn't always simple, because there is no one diet for one particular phase of life. There is no one diet for one particular thing. Although society and online might have you believe differently, it's nuanced from person to person. And it might sound annoying to answer it like that. But there is definitely a great way to eat in order to support your body. But that's not necessarily a specific diet in the way that someone might think of, you know, a low FODMAP diet for somebody who has small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, for example, or the keto, or, you know, particular like low histamine diet, for example. But essentially what I'm saying is the best diet for perimenopause is one that supports your whole body. This, not just your hormones, but your whole body. It's not about strict food rules or quick fixes. It's literally about building a nourishing foundation that helps you feel energized, that helps you sleep well, that helps you reduce frustrating, annoying, horrible symptoms like mood swings, weight gain, night sweats, brain fog, low mood, and so on. So it's about eating in a way that supports your body. And this, the way that the things that I'm going to talk about today, they're not only for perimenopause. These are supportive at any stage of life, but they do become just way more supportive and important as a woman's body moves from its 30s into its 40s and further along and beyond. So much more important, because this is a phase of life where we cannot just get away with, you know, skipping meals or skipping nourishing meals, skipping balanced meals, eating lots of refined carbohydrates, lots of sugar, lots of alcohol, lots of caffeine. The body was more resilient in its 20s and 30s. And it's not to say that those things were fine back then, but it's just to say that it was a little bit more resilient in I guess, dealing with that onslaught. But as we come into our 40s and we move through it and beyond, there needs to be so much more support and attention given to how we're supporting our bodies with regards to food. So let's just break this all down. So first of all, let's look at, I mean, if you've been listening to me, if you're part of my community, if you've been listening to my podcast episodes and maybe reading emails and blogs and Instagram, you'll already know, you know, why or what perimenopause is kind of doing to the body to potentially change how important diet and nourishment is. But I just want to break down why perimenopause changes everything. So the fluctuating estrogen levels that we start to experience as we move into our 40s, or for some, that fluctuation in estrogen is starting a bit earlier, for some a bit later, but that fluctuation of estrogen, this more erratic nature of it, more roller coaster like, coupled with the gradual decline in progesterone that we see very early on in our 40s, even late 30s, that starts to create a whole load of shifts in the body. Your metabolism, your blood sugar regulation is affected. your mood and sleep cycles, your circadian rhythm is affected, your ability to build and maintain your muscle mass, your bone density and your cardiovascular health, so your heart health, your thyroid health, your adrenal function, so your stress system, your gut health and your immune health. All of these different systems are impacted by that erratic nature of estrogen, that decline in progesterone. And it's no wonder that in the body, it can feel like everything is changing. For some, it feels like everything's changing all at once, or it's happened overnight. For other women, they say it's this sort of gradual change. They start to notice a couple of things or one thing. And then if you're like me, and I've got to 45, 45 and a half, and I'm like, whoa, I feel like in the last 4 to 5 months, I've been hit so hard, like harder than I've been hit in the 40, let's say from age 40 to 45, when I started to notice subtle gradual changes. The last 4 months have not been subtle or gradual. It's felt like just been hit on the head with a very heavy frying pan, and it's all just come at once. I mean, that's probably, or I'd say definitely is, coinciding with the fact that I made a massive move in terms of like location, from spending my whole entire life living in London and then moving to a small seaside town in the UK that we are enjoying. But it's a very big change, a very big move. There's just so much going on in the body. All our different systems are impacted. And so it's just no wonder that we can move into our 40s and feel like everything's changing or shifting in a way that we just don't know. We don't know how, we don't know why, and we don't really know what to do. But food is one of the most powerful tools that we have to regain balance and resilience. It really is. It's not the be all end all. There's so many different things that feed into it, which is why I've talked about my four sort of foundational pillars, which is what I address with every one-to-one client, and what my Midlife Thrive group program membership is based on. And then after those, we've addressed those four foundational pillars, we then move on to progress that into other areas. But the four foundational pillars, one of those is food. And then the other three, you have sleep, we have stress management, we have movement. So food is not, of course, the be all end all, but it's so, so, so important. And it really can be, or is, that place that we need to address in order to start helping bring balance back to the body and resilience to our systems and our nervous, including our nervous system. So let's go through then the foundational nutritional pillars. And it doesn't have to be complicated. In fact, it is really not complicated. And I think a lot of people overthink and overlook the basics, and then because they're sort of expecting something like this to be complicated and big and to need this big plan, and they need to find this one perfect plan, and then they'll follow it and literally, you know, stick it up on the wall, have it on an app on their phone and follow it. And so we tend to, because we're overthinking it and assuming it's got to be difficult as well, maybe even restrictive and horrible, we're just overlooking the basics. And the basics are actually quite enjoyable for most people if you're open to eating, you know, most foods, all foods. And simple as well. It's not difficult if you just know what these foundational pillars are. So the first one is prioritize protein. This is always going to be the first one, because all of the other things are great. If protein isn't prioritized, it's not going to do much. It's not going to help much. I speak to so many women that are talking about they're on this diet, they're on that diet, they eat loads of this, they eat loads of that, eat so many vegetables, and you know, all of that stuff is great. I'm like, okay, but how much protein do you have in each meal? And they'll say things like, oh, enough, or oh, loads. But if I dig deeper into that, maybe they've asked me to, maybe they're a client, then I'll usually find that the protein intake on all of their meals, most of their meals, is no more than about 15 grams. And for some meals, particularly their breakfast, you're looking at about 5 grams. And we really, really want to be prioritizing at least 30 grams of pure protein with every meal. So all of those other things are great. You eat a lot of vegetables, you do eat healthy fats, you're not scared of fats, you know they don't make you fat, etc. But where's the protein has to be, it really is the prioritization, and then those things as well. So we want to be aiming for 1.5 grams of protein per kilo of body weight. So again, you know, we can calculate that. If you weigh 60 kilos, 1.5 grams of protein per kilo body weight for you is 90 grams per day, and that should be a minimum. Research shows that the absolute minimum for let's say the average woman before 40 would be 1.2 grams of protein per kilo of her body weight. As we move into our 40s, the absolute minimum should be 1.5. That was shown to be more protective of muscle mass and bone density in women over 40. So that's the minimum. If we're looking for optimal, and we're taking into account that we maybe lift weights two to three times a week, we have, more activity throughout the week, then or even if we have more, let's say we might have more body weight, more body fat, I should say, to lose, then we definitely want to do more than just the minimum being 1.5 grams. So that's the minimum of the optimal range of protein. The higher end of that, of the optimal range, is about 2 or 2.2 grams of protein per kilo of your body weight. So again, if you weigh 60 grams and you want to be at the higher end of the optimal range, then you're timesing your body weight by 2. So you're looking at 120 grams of protein per day. So that is 40 grams per meal if you ate 3 times a day. If you're going to look at 90 grams a day intake, then you're looking at 30 grams of protein per 3 meals. So it's if you break it down like that, this is how much I need in total, this is how much then I'll get across my 3 meals, because it really should be split evenly across 3 meals. We don't want to be overloading at lunch and dinner and just not having enough at breakfast. We have to make sure we're sort of giving ourselves these doses of protein around every roughly 4 hours, right? So that would be breakfast, lunch, dinner. Breakfast being the most important meal, the meal that breaks your fast is the most important place to get that optimal dose of protein. But if we split it evenly, then we're just getting that optimal dose of protein with all 3 meals. So that's even better. But we definitely just don't want breakfast to be that meal that falls short of that minimal optimal amount. So being, you know, the minimal optimal total dose being 30 grams per breakfast. This supports muscle mass, satiety, so it's going to reduce cravings, not just like straight after breakfast, but what we eat first thing in the morning, what we break our fast with, or what time we break our fast has a huge impact on cravings later on in the day. So if you have a low protein breakfast, you're likely to find yourself craving and hungry in the afternoon, probably mid to late afternoon, looking for something sweet, maybe looking for caffeine, maybe just absolutely starving and you're just going to eat anything that comes your way. Whereas if you then test this out and put in 30 grams of protein in breakfast tomorrow, for example, you should be amazed and very pleasantly surprised at how balancing that is for cravings, for your appetite later on in that day. And it also has a knock-on impact to how you sleep, how you fall asleep, how you stay asleep, and the quality of your sleep. So yeah, we're looking to support muscle mass, satiety, metabolism, so metabolic health as a whole, insulin resistance, all of these really important health markers, and of course, hormonal balance. Nothing is more balancing to the body, including our hormonal system, than protein when it comes to food. So examples of protein, obviously the ideal scenario is someone is eating all proteins, animal proteins, meat, fish, everything. So things like organic, preferably if budget allows or availability, organic free range chicken, turkey, preferably organic grass fed beef, lamb, various cuts, mince, however you like to have it, however it would work for you through the week, all fish, any and all types of fish, eggs, ideally free range, organic if budget allows, but free range is good enough. Tofu, so that's tofu and tempeh, they're basically from whole sources of soy, edamame beans. So that's the only type of soy that really we want to be eating. We don't want to be having any sort of processed forms of soy, you know, from soy meat replacement burgers and sausages and things like that. We just want to be sticking to edamame beans themselves, or tofu or tempeh, which is a fermented version of tofu. Lentils, beans, all the different beans, high quality protein powders where needed. So some of my favorite brands include Pulsin, Sun Warrior, Bulk, Form Nutrition, always going for unflavored versions and just flavoring them yourself with, you know, some berries in a smoothie, or maybe you're just going to add these protein powders into foods to increase the protein, for example. So they can be really helpful as well. And then this takes us on to the next point, which is eating blood sugar balancing meals. So if we are prioritizing protein, then we're having a blood sugar balancing meal already, because protein is that nutrient, that one, that food group that is going to balance, stabilize blood sugar levels. So that basically means it controls how the speed, how quickly our blood sugar levels rise in response to eating. And the more controlled that is, the more balanced our blood sugar levels are, the more balanced we feel mentally, emotionally, and physically. And that also has a lovely knock-on impact to weight and body composition. So in terms of how we would structure a meal for a blood sugar balancing meal, it's essentially filling about a quarter of your plate with that protein. But just think about that in terms of what we just explained, the having a minimum 30 gram dose of protein per meal. So that is, for example, one chicken breast, one cooked, always think in terms of cooked weight as well, because raw weight is, let's say you have a piece of chicken breast that weighs 150 grams raw. Once you've cooked it, you lose about 25% of the weight. So then let's say you've got, let's say you've got like 100 or so grams of chicken breast once it's cooked. Of that 100 gram chicken breast, you're getting about 27 to 30 grams of protein, 25 to 30 grams of protein in that breast. So that's what that quarter of your plate would look like, for example. Or it could be a steak for a lamb chop, or it might be say like 2 to 3 eggs mixed with something else, because eggs, each egg is 5 grams of protein, 5 to 6 grams of protein. So if you had 2 to 3 eggs, you're looking at 10 to 15 grams of protein. So you then use something else to get some protein, maybe some fish, maybe some chicken, you know. So just that quarter of your plate to be made up of various foods or one food that yields 30 grams of protein. Then we'll have healthy fat. So about 1 to 2 tablespoons of something like half an avocado, or it could be olive oil. So 1 to 2 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil put over your meal. It could be coconut oil, coconut milk. You know, these are just random things that you wouldn't obviously put coconut oil necessarily on top of your chicken breast, but however it might work, it might be that you're going to have Thai green chicken curry with chicken breast or chicken thigh, and then you're going to use full fat coconut milk in there. So that would be your healthy fats. You might already be having some good fats coming from your protein, which would be, let's say, salmon steak, which is a protein because it's a fish, but it's also got some healthy fats. It's an omega-3 fat. Things like nuts, seeds, nut butter, other kind of oils like flax oil, avocado oil. So any type of sort of couple of tablespoons in equivalent size of good fats in every meal. Your slow carbohydrates, so slow release or complex carbohydrates, being the carbohydrates that break down much slower into glucose, into sugar, in the digestive process. So we get a slower release of glucose into the bloodstream than we would from a fast release or simple carbohydrate. So for example, a white wrap, a big white baguette, a bagel, a big plate of white pasta, big plate of pasta, a big plate of rice. These would break down quite quickly into glucose because they're simple, quick release carbohydrates, versus something like about a fist sized portion of some sweet potatoes, some quinoa, some wild rice, some brown rice, some baby new potatoes, like 2 to 3 or 3 to 4. These would break down. The portion size is much, much healthier, much more controlled. And also the type of carbohydrates that they are, they will just break down much slower into glucose. So that helps to control blood sugar levels. And alongside that healthy dose of protein, it's a winner. And then you want to fill about half of your plate at least twice a day, at least 2 meals a day, with lots of different colors of non-starchy vegetables. So this could be cooked. It could be raw. So it could be salad stuff. So I'd like to, a friend of mine calls salads with lots of different things in it, a busy salad. So it could just be a very busy salad with lots of different types of colors of non-starchy veg. So bell peppers, red, yellow ones, tomatoes, red onions, spring onions, different types of leaves like watercress, rocket, spinach, baby kale, lamb's lettuce. There's loads of different types of leaves that we can be using as a base. There could be avocado, which would also be a healthy fat. It could be red cabbage shredded into the salad. So all different colours and types, or it could be a stir fry where you've just chopped up loads of different types of non-starchy veg and thrown them into a pan. You could use frozen vegetables. I like to use a lot So cauliflower, broccoli, green beans, just having them in the freezer all the time to throw them into a stir fry with other vegetables I might have in the fridge, like leeks and asparagus and spinach, kale, whatever it might be. So that is what a very nourishing, balanced, blood sugar balancing meal would look like. The next thing, once we're doing that 3 times a day, and yes, this might mean starting to look at your breakfast and see, okay, well, I'm always, you know, my whole life I've been doing, let's say, toast, maybe toast with peanut butter or toast with nut butter, or toast with a couple of eggs, or I have a couple of eggs with avocado. I hear that a lot. And whilst these are great things, like eggs and avocados, obviously 1,000 times better than your croissant for breakfast or a bowl of cereal or even a bowl of oats, which is essentially just a bowl of carbs for breakfast, it's still falling short of the amount of protein that we need. So like I said, a couple of eggs would be about 10 to 12 grams of protein. So we would just want to be adding more things to that. So yeah, I can't remember. I've literally lost my train of thought on that one, but I think I was just reiterating how important, you know, getting enough protein at each meal, and particularly breakfast, is where most of us fall short. So yeah, oh, that's what I was saying. So see, this is the brain fog. This is my perimenopause brain basically every day, but it always finds its way in the end. So I've learned to just accept that, okay, I'm in a little brain fog moment, but I know it's going to come back. And now I'm just more honest. I tell people in the moment, okay, I'm having a bit of a moment in my brain. It's going to come back in a minute, rather than getting stressed and embarrassed. So that's what I've just done with you guys. So yes, I was saying that some of you might be listening to this thinking, okay, that all sounds well and good, but my breakfast doesn't look anything like that ideal plate you just described. So that's why I say have half a plate of vegetables with at least 2 of those 3 meals a day, if not every day you can manage that at breakfast. But when it comes to breakfast, really, really take a look at it. See where you might be able to just switch up habits of a lifetime. And actually say, okay, you know, because I hear it a lot as well. Oh, but I've always had breakfast. I've always just had a couple of slices of toast and nut butter, or I've always just had 2 eggs and avocado. I've been doing that for the last 10 years. That doesn't mean you have to always do that. We can change. We can change on any given moment, any given day. We can decide to do things differently. So I always encourage my clients as well, like, if you're used to sweet-based breakfasts, yes, that's what you're used to, but that's because you've been conditioned that way. That's, you know, we all grew up in that era. If you're of an age of, you know, if you're in your 40s or 50s, we grew up in the era of sweet stuff for breakfast. Just have a bowl of cereal and leave the house. Just have a couple of slices of toast and leave the house. You know, this is not fuel. This is not fuel in any way for kids, for adults, let alone women in their 40s riding the hormonal waves of perimenopause and transitioning into menopause. Absolutely, this is not fuel. So we have to listen to these sorts of, you know, episodes like this where I'm talking about things like this. And we have to say, right, I have to start doing things differently. If I want to feel better, if I want to move through my 40s with more ease and grace and balance and have an easier time when I get to menopause, I do have to start making changes. And breakfast is usually that place. Or of the hundreds of food diaries I've looked at over the years and continue to see all week, it's always breakfast. I'll always say that it's like lunch and dinner are good. Lunch and dinner's okay. Or dinner's the best one for most people because they're at home and they're cooking their meat, their veg, and you know, they can easily add their fats to that. But they'll fall short at lunch if they're just on the go and they're grabbing a wrap or something. And they usually fall short at breakfast because again, they're on the go and they're just quickly hoovering some toast or cereal and then they leave the house. Or like I said, they've moved up a little bit, they've upgraded their breakfast a bit, but they're on 2 eggs and some avocado. So they're still missing about 20 grams of protein. Okay, so let me move on from banging on about breakfast, but hopefully that's been helpful. So once we've got those 3 balanced meals, we do then want to think about avoiding snacking between meals. This really is helpful to allow insulin levels to stabilize, to allow blood sugar levels to just, you know, ride, sort of, we're stabilizing blood sugar first thing in the morning with that nice protein-based balanced meal that I've just described. And then we're waiting maybe 4-ish hours to have lunch and then another sort of 4 to 5 hours to have dinner. If between lunch and dinner, that gap is going to be much longer than that, which for most people it is, for me it is. If I have lunch, I just had my lunch at 1 o'clock. So 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So 5 hours later will be 6. My dinner's usually not ready until about 7 by the time I've finished and my partner's ready to, and we start cooking and stuff. So there is a bigger gap there. So about 4 o'clock, I usually have 3 or 4 o'clock, I'll have some protein-based snack. So it might, or sort of mini meal. It might just be that I make like a good quality whey protein smoothie with some berries and some fats. Or I might do really good. I love Manchego cheese, sheep's cheese. And I'll maybe have some cheese with celery, or some kind of, like, if I've got some chicken in the fridge, or if there's sometimes a little bit of fish left or some prawns. I'm always sort of keeping in mind whenever I'm cooking throughout the week, oh, shall I make a little bit more of whatever this is, to then just keep in the fridge for my kind of 3:30, 4 o'clock protein snack. And if none of that's available, then I usually just do a whey protein smoothie, which is great because it's a really helpful way to get things like seeds, you know, different, like flax seeds and pumpkin seeds and sunflower seeds, just thrown in as well, when I might otherwise not eat those things if I was just going to eat them by hand. So trying to avoid snacking, because it can just start to disrupt our blood sugar levels. It's also not fantastic on our digestion. If we're just eating, we're asking our digestive system to start processing food, you know, every 2 hours or something. So for some people, of course, grazing all day can be helpful, and maybe it's really important for them. But for the most part, the average woman moving through her 40s would be really serving her body really well if she had 3 solid meals a day. And she also didn't fast too long overnight. So this is something really, really important. I see this all the time. So many women saying, I don't eat breakfast till 11. I don't eat breakfast till 10. This is probably causing more disruption to blood sugar and cortisol levels, so stress hormones, than anything protective. So for the most part, if we're waiting until 11 or even 10, 11, 12 o'clock in the day, and let's say you finish your dinner at 8 p.m., ideally you just want to leave a minimum 12-hour window between finishing dinner and starting your breakfast the next day. So if you finish dinner at 8 p.m., start your breakfast at 8 a.m., you can take that fast from 12 hours up to, say, 13, 14. For most women, the sweet spot is 13 to 14 hours. And depending on what you're doing the next morning, for some women, they just have to do the 12 hours because they have to eat before they leave the house. Or if you're like me and you're going to go to the gym at, say, I finish my dinner around 7:30. If I'm going to go to the gym about 7:30, then I'm going to have a protein dose before I leave for the gym. So then for me, that was a 12-hour fast. But I have to do that. Otherwise, I cannot go to the gym fasted. And no woman in her 40s should be training fasted. For me, those days, it's a 12-hour fast. But when that's not the case, when I don't need to do that, then I will fast for 13, maximum 14 hours. And I'll push my breakfast to sort of 8:30, 9 o'clock. So that gives me like 13 and a half hour fast overnight. Anything longer than that can just start to disrupt blood sugar levels, in that they start to fall very, very low. That then kicks in your stress response, your cortisol, adrenaline gets increased, and you're just kind of running on adrenaline then until you finally eat. And then it's very difficult, once you've hit that point, it's very difficult to come back from that, for your hormones to come back from that. They kind of spend the rest of the day just trying to sort themselves out, and it really can backfire for many women. So 3 solid meals a day. We want to be, you know, focusing as well on fiber and things like phytoestrogen. So plant, sort of phyto meaning plant, estrogen is obviously the hormone. That's not to say there's any hormone in plant foods. I hear this a lot. Can't I just eat phytoestrogens to increase my estrogen? No, that's not accurate. But plenty of foods that contain phytoestrogens have been shown to have potentially a hormone balancing impact. In terms of how we feel, as opposed to levels of estrogen in our body, if we were to get tested, for example, if that makes sense. So we want to also be focusing on lots of fiber. So where I mentioned having at least 2 meals a day where you fill half your plate with colourful non-starchy veg, I mean, that's your fiber. There's no better fiber for your gut, for your body, for getting all your different nutrients and antioxidants in, than colourful non-starchy vegetables, and having at least two meals a day where you're filling half your plate with those. That's your number one fiber. But then also things like ground flaxseed. So if you are using flaxseed, which is, I really do encourage you to do, look to have about 1 to 2 tablespoons a day, but always make sure you're grinding. If you're buying like full flax seeds, because they're absolutely tiny, but if you're buying them full, not ground, which I encourage as well, grind them before you eat them, whether you're sprinkling them on a salad, whether you're putting them into soup or a stir fry, or putting them into a smoothie, grind them first. So I would use, like, for example, I have the NutriBullet and I've got the smoothie blender thing, what do you call it, and I've also got the one that grinds. So I grind a load of flax seeds probably like once or twice a week, and I just keep them in a Tupperware box, and then I'll put like a tablespoon or two into my food throughout the day. That's a wonderful source of fiber, also shown to be a phytoestrogen, so it can have a nice balancing effect on estrogen in the body, but as I said, not levels, just sort of symptoms wise. And it can also really help support the body's clearance of estrogen from the body via the gut. So it helps to kind of bind to estrogen that's already in the gut waiting to clear the body and then pass that out via a stool. So that's really important as well. Chickpeas, lentils, edamame beans, all the other types of beans as well, great sources of fiber. Berries, again, in terms of fruit, are a lovely source of fiber to add to those sort of the list of colourful vegetables that are full of antioxidants and other nutrients. That also includes lovely berries, so that's great to maybe put into smoothies. You can just keep them in the freezer. That's what I do. It's much more cost effective, and it's obviously better for food waste if they're just frozen. Sometimes I like to heat them up in a little pan from frozen and put them into some coconut yogurt or something as a little sort of dessert after dinner. And then in terms of what to limit or avoid, really what you're looking to avoid is anything that sort of worsens symptoms and increases your long-term risk of inflammation, chronic disease, which is the precursor for most chronic diseases, and impacts blood sugar. So that's really things like ultra processed foods, so processed snacks, refined carbohydrates as well. So as I mentioned a couple earlier, like white, you know, if you have a reliance on things like white wraps, bagels, pastries, white bread, pasta, white pasta, just all of these sorts of things, they'll have a bit of an impact, quite a significant impact on blood sugar regulation for us now. And they're also just full of processed white flour, which just isn't helpful in terms of, like I said, blood sugar, but also these can be quite inflammatory foods if we're relying on them too heavily. You know, ultra processed sort of protein bars and cereal bars and so-called health bars, if you read those ingredients, most of those sorts of bars are just full of rubbish, a whole load of things you probably don't even know or understand. And you'll always see on these sorts of foods, you'll usually always see things like sunflower oil or rapeseed oil or vegetable oil. These are the types of oils that we want to be avoiding, ideally. You know, cold pressed rapeseed or cold pressed sunflower oil, these might be okay in moderation. These are your omega 6 seed oils. In moderation, as long as we balance out in the diet with omega 3s, so that would be from your oily fish, for example, and algae. As long as we're balancing those fats out, then those cold pressed oils are okay. But what we get in these processed snacks and bars and crackers and things like that, long life baked goods in the supermarket, what we're getting in there is not cold pressed oils. We're getting sort of industrialized processed vegetable and seed oils, which have been shown to be potentially inflammatory in the body. So trying to avoid those sorts of foods, avoiding sweetened drinks, even if it's artificial sweeteners. So people say, oh no, I have Diet Coke, it's fine, I don't have the sugar. But then they've replaced the sugar with artificial sweeteners, which can do you know, just as much harm in different ways. In fact, studies have even shown that just because there's no sugar in it, even though there's no sugar in it, artificial sweeteners have in some people been shown to increase insulin levels because the brain is sensing the sweetness and the brain is instructing the release of insulin to deal with the sugar, even though there is no sugar. And so that's, you know, increasing insulin levels when we don't want that to happen. And also there's studies to show that various artificial sweeteners can be very harmful on the gut, really disruptive of that lovely gut microbiome that we're trying to keep nice and healthy. So either way, whether it's sugar sweetened or artificially sweetened, we want to avoid that as much as possible. Alcohol, of course, you know, in moderation, and people say in moderation all the time, don't they? What does that mean? What does that mean from one person to the next? In my eyes, it means if you have one drink, whether it's one glass of wine, one gin, with preferably soda water, not tonic, or like, you know, one vodka and soda, something like that. So whatever your drink is, just one of them, with maybe like with a meal a couple of times a week, it's fine. It's absolutely fine. But for the most part, but as we do move through our 40s, it does become more and more damaging to our hormonal picture and our metabolic health and our liver clearance, particularly of estrogen, which is so important. No matter what stage we're at in perimenopause and menopause, even when we stop making it, we still want to, you know, support the body to properly metabolize or break down our used estrogens and get it out of the body. And alcohol puts all of that kind of work that the liver would need to do for that on the back seat because it's too busy dealing with alcohol and all the other, you know, burdens, toxic burdens that we have in our modern day world. We want the liver to be able, we don't want the liver to be burdened. We want the liver to be able to do the job it needs to do. And too much alcohol coming in at any one time and too often creates a problem there. So trans fats as well, you might have heard of trans fats in excess. So trans fats, when people talk about trans fats, what we're really talking about is some of the stuff I've just touched on, like sort of industrialized processed seed oil and vegetable oil. So not your good quality cold pressed seed oils, but you're cooking the sort of cheaper cooking oils that we see in the supermarket and that restaurants use, obviously to save money, and also that we see in sort of in processed foods if we start to look at labels. And also margarine is a trans fat. So always just be using real butter, tastes better as well. And it's good for you. The body knows how to break that down. It's a good fat. It's a saturated fat, but it's a good fat that the body needs. And then deep fried foods. These are also trans fats. And processed meat. So essentially meat that probably isn't even real meat anymore. You know, ultra processed meats like Frankfurters, of course. I don't even know if they're real meat by the time it's a fully made product, but you know, compared to really good quality sources, if you were to kind of make your own burgers out of really good quality grass-fed organic beef mince, for example, or lamb mince, and you made your own burger patties at home, that's fine. That is a processed product because essentially you have processed the meat, minced it, but it's not ultra-processed, which is what most of these sort of processed meats that we buy in the supermarket would be. So those are the sorts of things to be avoiding. But good quality whole foods in their original form, including meats, all good. And then just being aware, as if we to go a little bit deeper, being aware of charred or overly fried and overly cooked foods that are actually blackened in certain places. These form what's known as age compounds that can promote inflammation in the body and aging, skin aging, literally the acronym is AGE. And that's advanced glycation end products, which is basically like the sort of end process of charred from the processing of from the charring of foods, basically. So that's just, you know, if we were going to be quite picky, then we would say that as well. So really and truly, you might be listening to this thinking, well, you know, they do talk about the Mediterranean diet being really great. And yeah, that's a strong, strong starting point. It ticks, the Mediterranean style eating ticks many boxes. It's anti-inflammatory, it's blood sugar balancing, it's rich in plant nutrients, phytonutrients, antioxidants from different colors and types of veg and berries. It's packed with heart healthy fats from oily fish, olive oil, nuts, seeds. It uses lots of herbs and spices, so lovely anti-inflammatory plant chemicals from turmeric, ginger, cinnamon. It uses whole grains, beans, lentils, and like I said, lots of olive oil, extra virgin olive oil, colourful vegetables. So that is a strong starting point. And then, of course, on top of that, you can add good quality meats that we talked about earlier, poultry, beef, lamb, all different types of fish as well. So in terms of, you know, what's the best, so people saying, what's the best diet? What I've just described and talked you through, it's not a short-term plan or some kind of fad or trendy fix. This is about building on these habits, implementing these habits and developing them over time. And this way of eating will support you for decades. It's not just a short time or while I'm in my 40s. And then when I get to menopause, I need to start Googling the menopause diet. This is how to support your body you know, all the time. But like I said, as we move into our 40s and through our 40s and beyond, it becomes so much more important to be focusing on these sorts of foods to nourish our body, and the sort of template of eating three balanced, nourishing meals a day, evenly split, ideally. And if you need something to bridge the gap between lunch and dinner, by all means, go for it. Make sure it's protein-based, healthy fat-based, vegetable-based, as opposed to grabbing a bag of crisps or some crackers or some toast or a muffin, for example. This is going to nourish your body well now, but also set you up for more energy, better sleep, fewer hormonal symptoms as you transition through perimenopause and menopause. It's going to support muscle mass, stronger bones. It's going to help to lower your chronic disease risk in the future. It's going to help improve your mood, your mental clarity. So that's the kind of take-home message, is that start small, focus on just one habit this week, if it's maybe just eating, getting that protein in that we discussed at the beginning with every single meal, particularly your breakfast, or swapping your mid-afternoon snack for a bigger lunch. That's something that's I meant to say as well when it comes to snacking. If I meet women who say they have to snack, then we're always digging into, well, what are you eating in your meal that's causing you to need to snack? And when they start increasing their meals, as per what I've been through just now, and they're genuinely having the right portions of everything and the right amount of protein with everything, they're amazed. They're saying, okay, well, it's taking me a bit longer to eat my lunch, but it's fine because I'm going to make it work, because they're committed to the cause. And they can't believe that they're going to dinner, or they're going from breakfast to lunch without having a snack. So it really is game changing. So if that's the first thing you focus on, may that be the first thing. But these little shifts, they add up, and you will feel the difference probably straight away. And then over time, that will have a compound effect and, you know, knock on impact on all these different aspects of your life and your well-being. If you want support, if you want support one-to-one, if you want support in my Midlife Thrive membership, we go deeper into all of this stuff, of course. It's what I live and breathe. So module one is an intro to perimenopause and all the different hormones and what's happening. But module two is all about how to fuel your body to thrive. And it's not diets, it's not calorie counting, it's no rigid rules. It's just going through what we went through today, but in a lot more detail and, I guess, a lot more supportive, a lot more resources for you. But yes, if you want that, if you want support on a one-to-one basis, of course, contact me. You can book a discovery call via my website or via my Instagram account, or you can drop me an email at francesca@francescaliparotti.com. You can also just head to my website and see the different ways you can work with me. Some of those are just ready to book and pay for instantly. And then the 3-month coaching package is the one where we need to have a discovery call first, so you can book that on there as well. So my final thoughts, just to wrap this up and to remind you, there's no one perfect perimenopause diet. There's no such thing as a perimenopause diet. If someone tells you there is, and they give you this plan to walk away with, I'm not sure how much you should be sort of buying into that. I'd be checking out where their credentials are and where they're getting that from, because there isn't just one perfect perimenopause or menopause diet, but there is a right approach for your body. And it's one that's consistent, nutrient rich, blood sugar supportive, deeply supportive for your hormones, your metabolism, your overall vitality. And we have talked about that in this episode, so I hope it's been helpful. And I just want you to feel inspired to make changes where you need to make them, but start with just one thing. You might listen to this thinking, well, I just know that I need to focus on vegetables. I just don't eat any, or I know I hardly eat any. She's talking about half a plate of different colored vegetables at least twice a day. I'm not doing that at all. So maybe that's where you start. And then maybe digestion starts to improve because you've added all this wonderful fiber. And then as a knock-on impact, you're sleeping better because your detoxification is working better, you know. And then you're thinking, okay, well, now I'll make sure I'm having 30 grams of protein with all meals. You might say, I'm already having protein with every meal. I know that. All the foods she talked about for protein, I have. But I don't think I'm getting 30 grams minimum. So then start working on that. See where you're naturally, how much protein you're naturally getting without even trying. Maybe it's 15 grams. Maybe it's 20, and then say, okay, well, without trying, my current way of eating gives me 15 grams per meal. I need to double that. How will I do that? So take your time. You don't have to do this overnight, because you should be in this for the long haul, because this isn't just a fad or, you know, temporary fix. So I hope this has been helpful, and I will catch you in the next episode. Bye for now. If you found this episode helpful, then please share it with anyone else who you think could benefit. And consider leaving a rating and a review, as this will help the podcast to reach and help more people. And if you need more guidance on your own health journey, you can grab my free guide, 6 Steps to Mastering Your Hormones in Your 40s, over at francescaliparotti.com, where you can sign up for your free copy. Or you'll also find the link in the show notes.